Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and you're about to hear the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for today, Friday, March 22nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at today's weather forecast first thing, this coming from KCRG. Slick roads likely as snow, wintry mix, falls across eastern Iowa. After weeks without having to deal with it, suboptimal road conditions are the case for wide swaths of eastern Iowa this morning. A wintry weather advisory is in effect for the morning hours of Friday for areas generally along and north of U.S. Highway 30. This is where wintry precipitation is most likely, with slick roads developing in many spots. Precipitation is likely for much of eastern Iowa throughout the morning hours on Friday, with many areas experiencing mainly frozen precipitation. For many areas north of U.S. Highway 20, this will likely fall as just snow, with a transition area of a bit of a mix of snow, sleet, and rain between Interstate 80 and Highway 20. As frozen precipitation begins, road conditions have gotten worse. Check your local weather conditions before you head out this morning. Precipitation rates will be moderate to even heavy at times, reducing visibility and further deteriorating road conditions at a more rapid pace. A few lightning strikes are possible too, though the chance for that is higher in the southern zone, where most precipitation is just plain rain. Some of the heaviest precipitation has been observed between Highway 30 and Highway 20 corridors, and that trend may continue through the morning. The highest area of the most widespread precipitation moving out of eastern Iowa is also on track for the main hours of the morning commute, further complicating travel for some areas. Since we've had an extended break from wintry conditions in most parts of eastern Iowa, it's a good idea to remember to use those safer winter driving techniques. While air temperatures and pavement temperatures will be near or above freezing in some cases, which will help road crews with keeping things clearer, you could still wind up in trouble without slowing down a bit. Give yourself that extra time to get where you're going, and also leave extra stopping distance at intersections and between you and the car in front of you. Total snowfall amounts will fall into a 2 to 4 inch range for much of the northern half of the area, with a band of a trace to 2 inches of snow south of that where mixed precipitation will take place. South of Interstate 80, most areas see just rain and should avoid much accumulation and the related travel impacts. Precipitation starts to wind down from northwest to southeast, beginning from mid-morning in the northwest to lunchtime toward the Mississippi River. Behind it, clouds likely stick around for a bit before clearing out somewhat later this evening or tonight. Winds could increase toward the 15 to 25 mile per hour range this afternoon and evening, potentially causing some minor blowing of snow. The wet nature of the snow and the potential for melting as temperatures inch above freezing this afternoon will likely limit any additional impacts from blowing snow, however. Dry weather continues into tonight, with temperatures dipping into the upper 10s to low 20s. We'll make it back above freezing again during the day on Saturday, when skies will start out fairly sunny, but turn cloudier throughout the day. Highs on Saturday reach the upper 30s to low 40s. It won't be much longer after that when precipitation again moves into eastern Iowa. An area of low pressure will develop on the plains and slowly move through the Midwest, tracking through western Iowa by early next week. As it begins to move through, an area of precipitation will arrive here by late Saturday night into Sunday morning. Enough cold air looks to be in place that most of it should start as either all snow or a bit of a rain and snow mix. Warmer air will be pulled into eastern Iowa as southerly flow develops ahead of the low, gradually changing that to plain rain by Sunday night. A period of time Sunday morning into the afternoon could feature snowy road conditions, especially the farther northwest you go in the area. This could cause some trouble for travel during that time, with slick conditions possible. If you're traveling farther out to the across the Midwest areas in the Dakotas and Minnesota, may see substantial amounts of snowfall as this storm moves through, with troublesome conditions more likely there. Now to the front page of the Courier, we open with the top story, Justice Department sues Apple. Prosecutors allege it illegally monopolized smartphone market. This story comes to us from the Associated Press and begins with a photograph of Attorney General Merrick Garland standing behind a podium and in front of a backdrop with American flag, and he's speaking at a news conference at the Department of Justice headquarters in Washington. Dateline, Washington, D.C. The Justice Department announced a sweeping antitrust lawsuit Thursday against Apple, accusing the tech giant of engineering an illegal monopoly in smartphones that boxes out competitors, stifles innovation, and keeps prices artificially high. The lawsuit, filed in federal court in New Jersey, alleges that Apple has monopoly power in the smartphone market and leverages control over the iPhone to, quote, engage in a broad, sustained, and illegal course of conduct, unquote. Quote, Apple has locked its consumers into the iPhone while locking its competitors out of the market, said Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, stalling the advancement of the very market it revolutionized, she said. It has, quote, smothered an entire industry, unquote. Apple called the lawsuit wrong on the facts and the law, and said it will vigorously defend against it. The suit takes aim at how Apple allegedly molds its technology and business relationships to, quote, extract more money from consumers, developers, content creators, artists, publishers, small businesses, and merchants, among others, unquote. That includes diminishing the functionality of non-Apple smartwatches, limiting access to contactless payment for third-party digital wallets, and refusing to allow its iMessage app to exchange encrypted messaging with competing platforms. It specifically seeks to stop Apple from undermining technologies that compete with its own apps in areas including streaming, messaging, and digital payments, and prevent it from continuing to craft contacts with developers, accessory makers, and consumers that let it obtain, maintain, extend, or entrench a monopoly, unquote. The lawsuit, filed with 16 state attorneys general, is just the latest example of aggressive antitrust enforcement by an administration that has also taken on Google, Amazon, and other tech giants, with the stated aim of making the digital universe more fair, innovative, and competitive. Quote, the Department of Justice has an enduring legacy taking on the biggest and toughest monopolies in history, said Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cantor, head of the Antitrust Division, at a press conference announcing the lawsuit. Today we stand here once again to promote competition and innovation for next generation of technology, unquote. Antitrust researcher Dana Srinivasan, a Yale University fellow, compared the lawsuit's significance to the government's action against Microsoft a quarter century ago, picking a tremendous fight with what has been the world's most prosperous company. Quote, it's a really big deal to go up and punch someone who is acting like a bully and pretending not to be a bully, she said. President Joe Biden has called for the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission to vigorously enforce antitrust statutes. While it stepped up policing of corporate managers and questionable business practices met resistance from some business leaders, accusing the Democratic administration of overreach, it's been lauded by others as long overdue. The case seeks to pierce the digital fortress that Apple Inc., based in Cupertino, California, carefully built around the iPhone and other popular products such as the iPad, Mac, and Apple Watch, to create what is often referred to as a walled garden, so its hardware and software can seamlessly offer user-friendly harmony. The strategy helped Apple attain an annual revenue of almost $400 billion and, until recently, a market value of more than $3 trillion. But Apple's shares fell by 7% this year, even as most of the stock market climbed to new highs, resulting in longtime rival Microsoft seizing the mantle as the world's most valuable company. Apple said the lawsuit, if successful, would, quote, hinder our ability to create the kind of technology people expect from Apple, where hardware, software, and services intersect, and would set a dangerous precedent, empowering government to take a heavy hand in designing people's technology, unquote. Apple has defended the walled garden as an indispensable feature prized by consumers who want the best protection available for their personal information. Quote, Apple claims to be a champion of protecting user data, but its App Store fee structure and partnership with Google Search erode privacy. Consumer Reports senior researcher Sumit Sharma said in a statement, the lawsuit complains that Apple charges as much as $1,599 for an iPhone and that the high margins it earns on each is more than double what others in the industry get. When users run an internet search, Google gives Apple a significant cut of the advertising revenue those searches generate. The company's App Store also charges developers up to 30% of the app's price for consumers. Quote, consumers should not have to pay higher prices because companies break the law, said Attorney General Merrick Garland. Left unchallenged, Apple would, quote, only continue to strengthen its smartphone monopoly, he added. But don't expect a verdict until 2026, which means the case could easily drag on with appeals. Legislators advance bill easing gas stations' ethanol transition. Story written by Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Iowa gas stations would have more flexibility in updating their pumps to comply with the renewable fuel rules under a bill Senate lawmakers advanced on Wednesday. The bill, Senate Study Bill 3187, builds on a 2022 law that requires most Iowa fuel retailers to offer E15, gasoline blended with 15% ethanol, by 2026. The law also required new fuel infrastructure to be compatible with the higher blended E85 fuel, which can be used by some flex fuel cars. Under the proposed bill, retailers that install new pumps and infrastructure would be able to transition to E85 compatible equipment more slowly. Until 2025, new pumps would need to be compatible only with E15 fuel. Starting July 1, 2025, new infrastructure would need to be compatible with E40 fuel, and infrastructure would need to be E85 compatible by 2030. Republican Senator Dan Zumbach of Ryan said the bill would give retailers more time to update their equipment without incurring the large costs that come with E85 infrastructure. Quote, the reason this bill came into play is to give some time to the manufacturers to get the equipment available for these retailers to put in place, he said. And until that time, it'll lower their cost to not have to have as expensive equipment until that time arrives, unquote. Zumbach and two other lawmakers voted to advance the bill out of a Senate subcommittee on Wednesday. It is now eligible for a hearing in the full Senate Appropriations Committee. Iowa officials have long sought to boost the production and sales of ethanol-blended fuels. Iowa is the largest national producer of both ethanol and the corn used to make it, and more than half of the corn grown in Iowa is used in ethanol production. E15 gasoline is generally around 10 to 20 cents cheaper per gallon than standard E10 gasoline. The Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, which represents Iowa's ethanol manufacturers, has registered in support of the bill. Sarah Allen, a lobbyist for the association, said it would lead to more ethanol being sold in the state. A lobbyist for the Iowa Corn Growers Association said they would prefer if the legislature increased the grants offered to retailers to update their infrastructure rather than changing the requirements. Quote, "We think you passed an amazing bill in the legislature in 2022, and we think that it is still the best course," the association's lobbyist, Mindy Poldberg, said. "Our first preference would be if instead of the delay, we would implement the current bill but raise the cap from the $50,000 amount," unquote. The Iowa Renewable Fuel Infrastructure Program provides grants to fuel retailers to pay for equipment upgrades, doling out grants up to $50,000 for those projects for large retailers. Lawmakers increased the grant amount and cost share for small retailers in the 2022 law. Representatives for Iowa's gas stations had mixed thoughts on the bill. Quick Trip has registered in support, and its lobbyist, Larry Blixt, said E15 is the company's most popular product. Allowing retailers to more easily transition to E15 infrastructure would increase those sales, he said. A representative for Casey's General Store said he was concerned that some required equipment compatible with E40 gasoline would not be widely available by the July 2025 deadline. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency recently approved a request from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and other Midwestern governors to permanently waive a summer restriction on E15 and sell it year-round. E15 sales are generally restricted in the summer months because of environmental concerns. Police support builds for proposed regulation of Iowa traffic cameras. Tom Barton wrote this story from the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Law enforcement officials advocated support on Wednesday for proposed legislation working its way through the House and Senate to regulate the use of automated traffic enforcement cameras across the state. And here the article begins with a photograph of one of those traffic enforcement cameras, and it's mounted to a pole, and it's kind of an elongated ellipse shape. It's in a white case and a mostly black face. A subcommittee advanced a bill that would require cities to obtain approval from the Iowa Department of Transportation for the placement of speed cameras along interstates and highways. The DOT rolled out a policy a decade ago in 2014, but the Iowa Supreme Court ruled the agency lacked the legal authority to regulate traffic cameras. The cities of Des Moines, Muscatine, and Cedar Rapids filed lawsuits in 2015, successfully challenging the DOT rules that prohibited cities from placing the systems on highways and interstates. The DOT had ordered some of those cameras turned off in 2015, sparking the lawsuit. Police chiefs from Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, and Altoona on Wednesday appeared at the legislature in support of measures in the House and Senate to preserve, regulate, and standardize automatic traffic enforcement across the state as an alternative to a separate effort that would ban their use. Cedar Rapids uses the cameras at 9 locations along its primary highway system and major thoroughfares for both speed and red light enforcement, including 4 speed cameras around the S-curve on Interstate Highway 380 near downtown. Cedar Rapids Police Chief David Dostal told lawmakers the cameras have resulted in a significant reduction in serious injury crashes over the past 3 years. Quote, "There's a change in traffic behavior resulting in traffic safety," Dostal said. Lawmakers have attempted several times over the years to prohibit or regulate the use of the devices, citing concerns over their growing use, including in smaller communities, and that they're principally being used to generate revenue because of a lack of funding. The devices capture video of vehicles speeding or running red lights. Law enforcement then reviews the images captured by a camera vendor and issues citations to the vehicle's registered owner. House Study Bill 740 advanced out of a three-member subcommittee Wednesday with unanimous support. It moves next to the House Ways and Means Committee. Iowa cities, including Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, Davenport, and Waterloo, see the cameras as traffic safety tools that reduce public safety costs, providing 24/7 traffic monitoring and enforcement at a significantly lower cost than deploying officers to those areas. That frees cities to focus strained resources elsewhere. Waterloo began using cameras in 2017 and installed fixed intersection cameras a year later. There are 23 speed and red light cameras at intersections across the city, including along U.S. Highways 218 and 63. A 2022 Legislative Services Agency report said there were at least 19 cities and towns across the state using the cameras. That also included Hudson, Independence, and Olwine in northeast Iowa. The Waverly City Council this week approved installation of traffic cameras, initially at three intersections. Law enforcement officials said they're willing to put guardrails on the use of traffic cameras to make sure that they're used as intended for safety purposes and support a regulatory structure that creates a reliable, standardized process. Quote, "I appreciate having this conversation about a regulatory bill. It's long overdue," Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert said. Quote, "There are jurisdictions out there that are doing it the right way, some that are not. But all the things I see in this bill on regulation side are things that we're already doing, things we've been doing since the inception," unquote. The bill codifies the previously adopted 2014 DOT rules. Cameras would only be allowed in areas with documented high crash or high risk locations that make it unsafe for police to make in-person traffic stops, such as the I-380 S-curve. Cities and counties would be required to apply to the Iowa DOT for permission to install a speed camera on a state highway or interstate and justify the location with data showing a high volume of crashes, as well as documentation of alternative solutions tried and considered but not implemented, including, quote, engineering and design changes and public education campaigns, unquote. The bill applies only to cameras used by local jurisdictions to monitor and enforce excessive speed violations on DOT-maintained primary road systems. The Iowa DOT would not have authority to regulate traffic cameras that issue tickets for vehicles caught speeding or running red lights on city streets. It also would prohibit the DOT from using automated traffic enforcement or receiving related payments from cities and counties. Senator Mike Klimisch, a Republican from Spillville, the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, who proposed the Senate regulation bill, said he intends to sit down with House lawmakers in the coming days to hammer out compromise language. Quote, "I've always been pro-regulation and look forward to continue to work on that as it moves forward and see what kind of compromise we can come up with," Klimisch said. Trump lawyers continue to fight $454 million judgment. Attorneys say former president would suffer irreparable harm. Story comes from the Associated Press, and the dateline is New York. Former President Donald Trump's lawyers kept pressing an appellate court Thursday to excuse him from covering a $454 million fraud lawsuit judgment for now, saying he'd suffer, quote, irreparable harm before his appeal is decided. It's the latest in a flurry of arguments and counterarguments that Trump's attorneys and New York State lawyers made ahead of Monday, when State Attorney General Letitia James can start taking steps to collect the massive sum unless the appeals court intervenes. James, a Democrat, said last month she is prepared to try to seize some of Trump's assets if he can't pay, though it wasn't clear how quickly. Trump's lawyers want the court to hold off collection without requiring him to post a bond or otherwise cover the nine-figure judgment while he appeals the outcome of his recent civil business fraud trial. Judge Arthur Engoron ruled that Trump, his company, and key executives deceived bankers and insurers by producing financial statements that hugely overstated his fortune. The defendants deny the claims. Now looking at local news from the Courier, Dyke's public pool will be closed this summer due to safety concerns. Dateline is Dyke. More children looking to cool off and swim will have to go elsewhere during their summer break. The city of Dyke will not open its pool this season due to a lengthy list of much-needed repairs. The city council unanimously voted to close it on March 13th after taking a tour of the facility. Mayor Sadie Six said this was bound to happen at some point because the pool is 47 years old. The city was made aware of its condition during annual budget presentations. Quote, there's been a short-term fixes in the past, so we're looking for more of a long-term fix, she said. And here we have a photograph of the pool. It's full of water, but there are no swimmers present. And it's in a residential area, you can tell by the houses in the background. The city provided a myriad of repairs the pool needs to the city council. Among those were finding and fixing a large water leak, replacing pool filters, completing cement work around and inside the pool, fixing pool return jets, and repairing pool gutters and other cosmetic fixes. No cost estimates have been determined yet. Once there is an estimate, city officials will work to find an engineering firm. Six said the closure is not due to a lack of funding to run the pool, but rather to look out for the residents. Quote, it didn't come as a surprise to anyone. I think the public was pretty understanding, she said. They know we're trying to keep the community and visitors to our community safe, unquote. Although the pool will be closed, Six noted the newly constructed splash pad at the Kruger-Hemmen Sports Complex will be open. Earlier this month, another Cedar Valley community considered closing its public pool. Waverly officials say the cost of needed repairs could affect the fiscal year 2025 budget. The city has not yet decided if the pool will be open. Former ATM manager sentenced to prison for stealing more than $3.4 million. Dateline Waterloo. The former manager of an ATM business stole more than $3.4 million from the business over a period of years, according to figures released during sentencing last week. James Eugene Dreyer, formerly of Gilbertville, was sentenced to 5 years in prison on Friday on charges of wire fraud and filing a false tax return. Following prison, he will be on supervised release for 3 years. Dreyer was initially charged with taking $1.9 million from Mobile Money, where he worked as the California-based company's manager of Midwest operations out of its Waterloo office. But court records indicate company officials estimated the office lost $3.4 million over the years Dreyer worked for the company. Mobile Money delivers and retrieves cash from ATM machines. In January 2021, Dreyer allegedly tried to cover up a shortage of money in Mobile Money's Waterloo vault by tampering with a lock and telling his bosses it wasn't working. He told them he needed a cash infusion from a Des Moines bank so Mobile Money could cover its ATM routes. The vault was supposed to contain $1.1 million, but when it was finally opened in February 2021, there was less than $100,000 inside, according to court records. On February 1, 2021, Dreyer sent 10 bank deposit tickets to Mobile Money, purporting to show that he had deposited $2.5 million in cash. But the bank deposit tickets were fraudulent, authorities said. That same month, Dreyer admitted to company officials he took money from the business, according to court records. A review by the company found other inconsistencies, including that there was less money in the ATMs than there should be. deposits Dreyer was supposed to make to a bank account never occurred. Cash from ATMs that were uninstalled from Casey's convenience stores never reached the bank, and routes that were supposed to be run that never were, according to court records. Prosecutors said Dreyer never reported the stolen funds on his income tax filings over a period of years. As part of his sentence, Dreyer was ordered to pay $3,407,000 in restitution to Mobile Money Incorporated and the company's insurance carrier. The case was prosecuted by Assistant U.S. Attorney Anthony Morfitt and investigated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Internal Revenue Service's Criminal Investigations Division. And now, listeners, we'd like to just take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, March 22nd on IRIS, that's I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial today comes from the Des Moines Register, and it was written by guest opinion writer Heather Hampton Knudel. The title is CN Iowa Northern Combination: Agricultural Producers Will Benefit from Cost Efficiency. A crucial piece of the supply chain and one of the most cost-effective modes of transportation, an efficient rail system, is a make-it-or-break-it dynamic to being profitable in any production industry, namely agriculture. Across the Midwest, farmers like me focus on turning out the agricultural products that feed our country. Among these states, Iowa ranks first in producing grain, along with several other agricultural goods. The freight rail network in the region plays a crucial role in transporting corn, soybeans, biofuels, and manufactured goods from the state to markets around the world. In December 2023, Canadian National Railway Company, referred to as CN, finalized an agreement to combine with Iowa Northern Railway, IANR. The added efficiencies of this combination will have a positive ripple effect for farmers and ranchers across the state. The acquisition will bring additional single-line service to the region, ultimately increasing speed to market, reducing inventory carrying costs, and time delays from switching between carriers, and will minimize potential plant shortages from the producer to the elevator to the buyer, reducing these inefficiencies that can hamstring the supply chain is immensely beneficial. Canadian National Railway was already one of the leading transportation carriers connecting Iowa Northern Railway, meaning there is no disruption through this acquisition. Essentially, it streamlines the supply chain, minimizing the commodity training hands and maximizing the opportunity to improve the market. With agricultural production costs at an all-time high, these efficiency boosts would be welcomed by Iowa farmers and the industry as a whole. Access to a broader rail network for shippers comes with this combination, which means a broader buyer base or greater reach to customers for agricultural products. This combined company will provide access to CN's 18,600 miles of rail network that extends from eastern to western Canada into southern United States. That linkage into Iowa's established distribution centers and the communities that they serve amplifies and benefits the product and the producer, and thus the local economy. Ultimately, CN combining with Iowa Northern is a win for farmers and rural communities. It comes with no disruption to the line, an improvement in handling costs, higher speed of production placement, and time efficiencies, as well as reach to expanded markets and network. Though the railroad combination is subject to review by the U.S. Surface Transportation Board, which is expected to conclude in 2024, the federal regulators did just deem it a minor transaction. That is the appropriate classification, and review process should be swift so that Iowa agricultural producers and rural communities can reap the benefits of this deal and the long-term opportunities that will come with it. Heather Hampton Knudle is a grain and cattle farmer from Illinois who has served in national leadership roles with the agriculture, precision technology, and waterway sectors. Now from the New York Times, Paul Krugman, we have an opinion piece titled, Are Immigrants the Secret to America's Economic Success? When we accuse a politician of dehumanizing some ethnic group, we're usually being metaphorical. The other day, however, Donald Trump said it straight out. Some immigrants are, quote, not people, in my opinion, unquote. Well, in my opinion, they are people. I'd still say that even if the migrant crime wave Trump and his allies harp on were real, and not a figment of their imagination, violent crime has, in fact, been plummeting in many cities. And I'd say it even if there weren't growing evidence that immigration is helping the U.S. economy. Indeed, that it may be a major reason for our surprising economic success. But as it happens, there is a lot of evidence to that effect. Some background here. When COVID struck, there were widespread concerns that it might lead to long-term economic scarring. Millions of workers were laid off. How many of them would either depart the labor force permanently or lose valuable skills? Investment and new business formation fell. It seemed plausible that even after the worst of the pandemic were behind us, America would have a smaller, less productive workforce than previously expected. None of that happened. If we compare the current state of the U.S. economy with Congressional Budget Office projections made just before the pandemic, we find that real GDP has risen by about a percentage point more than expected, while employment exceeds its projected level by 2.9 million workers. How did we do that? American workers and businesses turned out to be more resilient and adaptable than they were given credit for. Also, our policymakers didn't make the mistakes that followed the 2008 financial crisis, when an underpowered fiscal stimulus was followed by a premature turn to austerity that delayed a full recovery for many years. Instead, the Biden administration went big on spending, probably contributing to a temporary burst of inflation, but also helping to ensure rapid recovery. And at this point, the inflation has largely faded away while the recovery remains. Beyond that, the very surge in immigration that has nativists so upset has played a big role in increasing the economy's potential. The Budget Office recently upgraded its medium-term economic projections, largely because it believes that increased immigration will add to the workforce. It estimates that the immigration surge will add about 2% to real GDP by the year 2034. But are immigrants taking jobs away from the native-born Americans? No. A recent analysis by Goldman Sachs contains a really interesting chart. This chart shows no rise in native-born unemployment during the immigration surge. It does show a rise in foreign-born unemployment, which I'll come back to. But for now, let's just note that there is no good evidence that immigrants are taking away jobs from workers born in America. Still, doesn't immigration put downward pressure on wages? That sounds as if it could be true. In particular, you might think that immigrants with relatively little formal education compete with less educated native-born workers. I used to believe this myself, but many, though not all, academic studies find that immigration has little effect on the wages of native-born workers, even when those workers have similar education levels. Instead of being substitutes for native-born workers, immigrants often seem to complement them, bringing different skills and concentrating in different occupations. In some ways, the current immigration surge probably consisting mainly of less educated workers, especially among the undocumented, is a test case. Have wages for lower wage workers declined? On the contrary, what we've seen recently is a surprising move toward wage equality, with big gains at the bottom. Overall, then, immigration appears to have been a big plus for U.S. economic growth, among other things, expanding our productive capacity in a way that reduced the inflationary impact of Biden's spending programs. It's also important to realize that immigration, if it continues, and if a future Trump administration doesn't round up millions of people for deportation, will help pay for Social Security and Medicare. CBO expects 91% of adult immigrants between 2022 and 2034 to be under 55, compared with 62% for the overall population. That means a substantial number of additional workers paying into the system without collecting retirement benefits for many years. Finally, let me return to that Goldman Sachs chart on unemployment rates, which shows no rise in unemployment among the native-born, but a significant rise among the foreign-born. Believe it or not, that's probably good news. Goldman argues that the rise in foreign-born unemployment reflects a long-standing tendency for recent immigrants to have relatively high unemployment, presumably because it takes some time for many of them to get settled into sustained employment. Unemployment is much lower among immigrants who have been here 3 years or more. Why is this probably good news? The overall U.S. unemployment rate has crept up recently, not enough to trigger the Sham rule, which links rising unemployment to recessions, but enough to make me and others a bit nervous. Goldman argues, however, that this time is different. All of the rise in unemployment is among foreign-born workers. And this, they suggest, means that we aren't seeing the kind of weakening in demand for labor that presages recessions. What we're seeing instead, they argue, is an increase in labor supply, with many of the new workers taking some time to find their feet. If so, the Sham rule, which has been spectacularly successful in the past, may currently be misleading. I hope they're right. The bottom line is that while America's immigration system is dysfunctional and really needs more resources, resources it would be getting if Republicans, pushed by Trump, hadn't turned their backs on a bill they helped devise. The recent surge in immigration has actually been good for the economy so far and gives us reason to be more optimistic about the future. The potency of Trump's lost cause myth-making. This was written by Charles M. Blow of the New York Times. At an Ohio rally this month, Donald Trump saluted the insurrectionists who stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021, calling them, quote, unbelievable patriots, and referring to those who have been locked up for their involvement on that terrible day as hostages. This was a continuation of Trump's lost cause myth-making that began during his successful presidential campaign in 2016 and was ramped up in service of his efforts to remain in power despite his 2020 loss and the deadly riot that those efforts stoked. More than 1,200 people have been charged related to January 6th, and though it shouldn't have to be said, let's be clear. Those who have been tried, convicted, and imprisoned for storming the Capitol aren't hostages. They're criminals. But lost cause narratives aren't about truth. They're about negating the truth, which is what happened when the lost cause mythology was constructed after the Civil War. The cause of the war was framed as Northern aggression rather than slavery, a lore about happy slaves and benevolent enslavers proliferated. The narrative valorized those who seceded from and fought against the United States, and it has survived to some degree for over 150 years, tucked into the cracks of our body politic. It still surfaces in ways that may seem remote from the Confederate lost cause myth, but that definitely promote it. It manifested itself last year when Florida changed its African American history standards to say that the enslaved, quote, in some instances, benefited from their enslavement. And in Nikki Haley's hesitance on the campaign trail to state the obvious, that slavery was the cause of the Civil War. It manifested itself in the infamous Torchlight March in Charlottesville and in the bitter resistance to removing Confederate monuments. Trump has his own version of the lost cause, one that's not completely untethered from the old one, but one that's miniaturized, personal, and petty. The Confederate lost cause narrative came after enormous loss. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers had died. The South was decimated, and its economy was hobbled. Trump's lost cause, on the other hand, is about the grievances he promotes, his inability to accept losing to Joe Biden, and his utter disregard for democratic norms. Trump's version grows out of a more recent vintage of the lost cause narrative, one that has been around at least since George Wallace's first presidential campaign in the 1960s, one in which a sense of displacement and disposition is driven by a lost cultural advantage. David Goldfield, a historian at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and the author of, quote, Still Fighting the Civil War, The American South and Southern History, told me that many of Trump's supporters feel that they've lost something similar to what white Southerners felt they had lost after the Civil War. Quote, they are no longer relevant. They are no longer listened to. And on top of that, there were lots of other voices that were in play in public that were not there before, unquote. The Pulitzer Prize-winning Yale historian David Blight, who has written on several occasions about Trump's lost cause, told me that Trump's iteration has all the necessary elements, a story of loss, culprits, ready-made villains, and, quote, an enormous narrative of grievance. As Blight explained, Trump, quote, feeds on this imagined tale of what could have been, should have been, might have been, and once again can be retrieved. The glory can be retrieved, unquote. And Trump invokes his lost cause in combination with other false telling, one of unprecedented happiness and unity, in which all the glory belongs to him. As he told a crowd at Mar-a-Lago on Super Tuesday, quote, African American, Asian American, Hispanic American, women, men, people with diplomas from the best schools in the world, and people that didn't graduate from high school. Every single group was doing better than before, unquote. He continued, quote, our country was coming together, unquote. What he ignores is that his presidency began with the Women's March the day after his inauguration and ended long after the 2020 summer of protests driven by outrage over the murder of George Floyd. Trump didn't bring the country together. He tore it further apart. Unlike previous lost cause appeals, Trump's has the advantage of a modern communications environment, 24-hour cable news, an internet replete with partisan news sites and social media, an octopian virtual world that reaches deep into the darkest places of our politics. And Trump's appeal is getting a do-over, a chance not to simply recast history, to win the narrative, but to win the actual contest and convert an electoral loss into an electoral victory. In this election, disciples of the MAGA movement not only have an opportunity to enshrine Trump's fallacies, MAGA also might rise again. This next editorial appeared in the New York Times and was written by Peter Coy, a big step toward a fairer housing market. Some overcharges are right there for everybody to see. One of them is how much Americans have to pay to buy or sell a house. The combined commission paid to agents for buyers and sellers is typically 5% to 6%, compared with below 2% in Britain, the Netherlands, and Sweden, among other countries, according to studies cited by the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. Fortunately, those commissions are coming under pressure, especially on the buyer's side. A tentative settlement reached last week by the National Association of Realtors could knock a percentage point or two off commissions, which would mean $5,000 to $10,000 off the price of a $500,000 house if all the savings went to buyers. The history of the real estate industry's effort to prop up commissions is long and inglorious. In 1939, the National Association of Real Estate Boards, the predecessor of the National Association of Realtors, formed a committee to standardize commission rates. By 1950, the 5% commission rate was an industry standard, and calls for 6% soon followed, unquote. That is according to an article in Chicago Agent magazine that was cited by the Justice Department in another case last month. For nearly as long, the Justice Department, the Federal Trade Commission, and private citizens have tried to break the industry's grip. Things started heating up in 2019 when private plaintiffs brought class action suits on behalf of home sellers in Illinois and Missouri. This past October, a federal jury in the Missouri case found that the National Association of Realtors and several big brokerage firms had conspired to follow and enforce a rule on how buyers' agents are compensated. Plaintiffs alleged that the rule inflated agent commissions. The jury ordered the defendants to pay $1.8 billion in damages. Several major brokerage firms have settled the claims against them with financial payments and an agreement to abide by future structural changes in the industry that would be part of a final settlement. What happened last week is that the National Association of Realtors reached a settlement on those structural changes, pending a judge's approval. The settlement doesn't discuss commission rates, only policies. It also agreed to pay $418 million in damages. The settlement covers the cases in Illinois and Missouri, as well as those in a number of other states. Most brokerage firms are covered, although not the biggest, Berkshire Hathaway-controlled Home Services of America. Stephen Brobeck, a senior fellow at the Consumer Federation of America, told me that the tentative settlement, quote, will eventually represent a great gain for consumers, unquote. He added, quote, it will be more difficult for the industry to fix prices. The wheels have been in motion for a long time. Mackenzie Moorman, a director of the financial services group of the policy analysis firm Capstone, told me. She said that some big real estate firms were probably surprised when the National Association of Realtors, which had been promising to vigorously fight the class action lawsuits, abruptly reached a tentative settlement. The problem in real estate has always been, as economists like to say, a misalignment of incentives. When I'm buying a house, I want my agent to be on my side. How can she be 100% on my side if the commission she earns is paid by the seller? Won't she be tempted to show me houses that make her more money? My agent can earn more for herself if she steers me to a more expensive house or to a house where the seller's agent is offering a bigger cut of the action. The National Association of Realtors has said that such things never happen because agents owe a fiduciary duty to their clients. Quote, this duty obligates a real estate broker to act at all times solely in the best interests of his principal, to the exclusion of all other interests, including the broker's own self-interest, an NAR brochure from 2013 said. On paper, maybe, but plaintiffs have introduced evidence that sellers don't dare cut commissions to buyers' agents for fear that the agents will steer customers away from them. To be clear, I'm not accusing real estate agents of behaving unethically. The ones I've worked with over the years have been great. It's the system that's the problem. I feel bad that fixing the system is likely to push a lot of people out of the business. I hope they find other work. The tentative settlement last week goes partway toward fixing the alleged misalignment in today's system. sellers are no longer permitted, let alone required, to post offers of compensation to buyer's agents on the multiple listing service, which is where houses for sale appear. But there's more to be done. The settlement still allows sellers to offer compensation to buyer's agents, just not via the multiple listing service. This strikes me as problematic. My agent is still beholden to the seller. A more pro-competition solution would be to ban all payments by sellers to buyer's agents. Buyers could do without an agent or could negotiate their own, presumably lower commissions. A 2022 research paper cited by the National Association of Realtors warns that, quote, minorities, lower-income households, and first-time buyers who rely more heavily on agent services would suffer the most from a ban on payments by sellers to buyers' agents because they couldn't afford to pay the agents out of their own pockets. Commissions to real estate agents for buyers and sellers add up to about $100 billion a year. Switching to a system that bases buyer agent commissions on cost, quote, could increase annual consumer welfare by more than $30 billion, the Richmond Fed study said. It could reduce agents' welfare at the same time, so the net benefit would be smaller. Still, I think, a step in the right direction. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for today, Friday, March 22nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier today or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service. And have a great weekend.